Welcome to this reading of City View for March of 2024. I'm Barbara Martin. City View is an alternative monthly published in Des Moines, and I will be doing this first episode of the March 2024 edition. We look first from the publisher, and the publisher is Shane Goodman, and he always writes this little introduction to tell you what's going to be in this edition. It's still rock and roll to me. Billy Joel penned those words in his number one hit of the same name from his Glass Houses album in 1980. I listened to it with my friends while roller skating. The roller skating rink has just closed, but Billy Joel rocks on, and so does that song. That is what's great about rock music. It lives on for decades, at least the good stuff anyway. But what exactly is the good stuff? That depends on who you ask. I've been wanting to publish a story listing the greatest rock songs of all time for more than two decades, but I could not find a writer with the courage to do it. Then along came Jackie Wilson, who has been handling our music coverage at City View for a few years now. And when I asked her about the idea, she immediately said, "Well, I will do it." To give the list perspectives other than her own, she sat in with our staff of a variety of ages and backgrounds and brainstormed on their thoughts on the greatest rock songs of all time. Interestingly, most of the suggestions were from outside of their generations of music, which was probably due to hearing the songs from their parents or older siblings. That would certainly be the case with me. Mom preferred country music, or country western music, as she called it, but she didn't hesitate to tap her feet and sing along to Elvis Presley, Chuck Berry, Fats Domino, Jerry Lee Lewis, Buddy Holly, and the Everly Brothers and the Big Bopper. And as such, I did too. My greater musical influences, though, came from the eight tracks of my brothers. That's where I heard the sounds of Kiss, Thin Lizzy, Aerosmith, Fogart, Alice Cooper, Steve Miller Band, and Grand Funk Railroad. I need to give my sister some credit here, too, as her 45s of Wings, Bob Dylan, Elton John, The Sweet, and Todd Rundgren found plenty of spins on my portable General Electric record player. As a married man with children, I subjected my three daughters to a barrage of my versions of rock, including many of the above mentioned, and some newer ones of the time, like Lenny Kravitz, Pearl Jam, Nirvana, Living Color, and the Black Crowes. So, what are the greatest rock songs of all time? Ultimately, that's up to you and to decide. But we are pleased to get the conversation started. Just remember, it doesn't matter what they say in the papers, cause it's always been the same old scene. There's a new band in town, but you can't get the sound from a story in a magazine. And now we turn to Ask City View. The City View can ask them anything by emailing editor@dmcityview.com. And our first question from listener, where and when did green beer start? Well, with March underway and St. Patrick's Day celebrations taking shape throughout the month, there is one tradition that has become synonymous with the holiday, green beer. Green beer was first invented, so to speak, in New York in 1914 by Dr. Thomas Hayes Curtin. He added a drop of wash blue to the beer, and out came a green beer that's still a popular trend more than a century later, according to the Steam Whistle Brewing. Today, green food coloring is added instead of blue wash. How many quick star convenience stores are in Iowa? According to the scraphero.com, as of January 2024, there are 140 total quick stars in Iowa, which is 16% of all quick stars in operation. Iowa ranks third out of the six states that have QuickStar locations, trailing behind Wisconsin and Minnesota. To break it down even further, there's a QuickStar for every 22,536 people in Iowa. Cedar Rapids and Waterloo are tied for the most locations in the state, with nine each. Will Come and Go convenience stores have a new name? The rumor mill has been swirling about changes to the Come and Go convenience stores since they were acquired by Maverik in August of 23. CSP Daily News stated that the change from Come and Go to Maverik is all but confirmed, at least according to their sources in the industry. None of the sources interviewed would agree to be quoted on the record, but multiple people with knowledge of Maverik's broader strategy said that upon deeper consideration and comprehensive assessment of the two chains, the Maverik brand resonated more impactfully in its markets than Come and Go did in the heart of its Midwestern terrain. When asked about the possible change in branding, Taylor Boland of Come and Go, Maverik responded, "Maverik has not announced any confirmed plans outside of rebranding stores in existing Maverik markets. These are markets where Come and Go and Maverik stores both exist and include Utah, Colorado, Wyoming, and Idaho." When was the latest snowstorm to hit Iowa? We posed this question to the National Weather Service of Des Moines on behalf of one of our readers. What defines a snowstorm is subjective, but using our winter storm warning criteria of 6 inches, the latest Des Moines event on record for a calendar day would be April 29, and that occurred in 1907. Well, if you go down to 3 inches, the last date would be May 3 of 2013. We don't have any big storms in the offing as of yet, but big snows in March are not uncommon, said Brad Small, lead meteorologist at National Weather Service of Des Moines. Now we turn to your view, this information we have about our readers. And looking at the poll position, this is the results from last month's poll. And the questions are, how often do you clean your toilet? Well, 54% went out there at once a week, 27% at once every 2 weeks, 9% both for once a day or once a month or less. And then we have, what do you buy your sweetie for Valentine's Day? 18.5% said dinner, 11% said a card, 7.4% chocolate, 3.7% flowers, and 14.8% said all of the above, whereas the biggest number, 44.4%, said none of the above. Well, that's your view for the day. But we do have a letter to the editor from Linda Smith regarding the success of a four-day school week. Would a four-day school week make the school day longer? Would it mean the kids on the fifth day won't get breakfast or lunch, especially those that are low income? And would it mean there would still be all the sports activities and everything else on the fifth day? Would it mean teachers have to give up pay or other benefits? One must also consider the parents' jobs, coordinating child care, and other hardships of life. There's so much work to be done with children these days. I understand a four-day school week will save money on buses and gas. However, those bus drivers won't be getting paid as much, and that would hurt them. I don't see where a four-day week would enrich more kids or teach more of anything. With the poor state of education in the state of Iowa, partially because the governor is stripping money away from this program and that program while the state continues to have a surplus of money, seems unreasonable. The kids need more time, more attention, more help with the basics, including reading comprehension, math, and other skills. Iowa needs to expand accommodation to those students who need extra help, IEPs, and other programs for disabilities. Because of Iowa's leadership, Iowa now ranks near the bottom in mental health care. We used to be top in education. Now we are clearly not. We are now a state that I don't recognize, says Linda Smith. And some stray thoughts from Randy Evans. Simple solutions rarely are simple or solutions. One of the fallacies of politics these days is the notion of simple solutions. Regardless of whether the problem is immigration, the homeless, gun ownership, or transgender people, too many leaders or would-be leaders want us to believe government can take simple actions to make a complex problem go away. Rarely do those simple solutions address the underlying problem. Often those solutions are not simple, nor are they really solving anything. Often these simple solutions are little more than gussied-up wedge issues designed to drive people into camps of us versus them. We have seen this with the issue of private ownership of guns. Statistics show that there are 393 million guns in private hands in the United States. So with two-thirds of American adults not owning a gun, that means the typical gun owner has almost four guns. So the simple solution of banning sales of semi-automatic firearms really does not solve the problem of mass killings. The problem is more complicated than can be addressed with one solution. It is the way with many other problems, too. This year, Iowans have been seen bills introduced in the legislature that are offered as supposed solutions to issues involving people who identify as transgender. One proposal would prohibit these people from using public restrooms that do not match their sex at birth. Another bill, one Governor Kim Reynolds introduced, would require transgender people to list both their sex at birth and their current gender on their birth certificates and their driver's license. Women and men are not identical, says she. They possess unique biological differences, and that's not controversial, Reynolds said in a statement. Actually, what these proposed laws would mean in real life is controversial, and Reynolds knows that. Consider these Iowans. In 2019, I met a 17-year-old Ames High School student and her proud parents at a luncheon hosted by the ACLU of Iowa. The student and I were there to receive awards. She was poised, personable, and impressively articulate. She also is transgender, meaning she was born with male genitals. Last year, a 7-year-old transgender girl from Ankeny testified before a legislative subcommittee considering a bill that requires transgender people to use K-12 school restrooms that match their sex at birth. I have a friend who was born with boys' genitals, but has transitioned in recent years through medications and surgery and now lives as a woman. The legislation being considered by Iowa lawmakers would dramatically affect the lives of these people. Their gender identity is not some switch they flipped on a whim. Their changes were the result of internal struggle, self-debate, and discussions with health professionals. As Senator Herman Quirmbach, an Ames Democrat, said last year, it is, quote, utterly irrational that males in Iowa would transition to females solely to get a spot on a girls' sports team or be able to use girls' restrooms or locker rooms. While I understand the concerns of people who don't want someone who is different from them sharing a bathroom or locker room, think about the real-life implications of these legislative proposals, and do not forget that 75 years old ago, there were people who feared what might happen if we allowed black people to use the same restrooms as white people. Has the governor considered how Lily, the 7-year-old from Ankeny, or Malika, the former Ames High School student, or my middle-aged friend would be greeted or treated in a men's bathroom? If we are to respect the anxieties of women who are concerned about a transgender person coming into their restroom, shouldn't our governor understand the concerns of transgender females who would be required to use a men's restroom because they were born with male genitals? Young Lily wisely told lawmakers last year, "I think you are confused about what happens in second-grade bathrooms. No one is hurting each other in there. We just go to the bathroom and wash our hands." But if Reynolds' legislation becomes law, the transgendered person who has been living as a female would be required to obtain a new driver's license and a new birth certificate showing both sex at birth and current gender. That means the ACLU honoree and my middle-aged friend would need to let people know their deep personal medical history whenever they had to show their driver's license, when cashing a check, renting a car, boarding an airplane, voting, or being stopped by a police officer. Much irony surrounds this. Politicians who support the governor's proposal were apoplectic about any requirement during the pandemic that people must disclose whether they had received COVID vaccinations, even though transgenderism is not contagious, whereas COVID can be. Pete McRoberts, the policy director for the ACLU of Iowa, told Iowa Capital Dispatch, "The driver license proposal is horrific because every time a driver's license needs to be shown is an opportunity for the transgender person to be discriminated against or humiliated. History can inform our current debates and discussions, but only if we are open-minded." Donald McCloskey was a nationally respected economist at the University of Iowa in the 1980s and 90s. In 1995, McCloskey, then 53, decided after many years of reflection to cross the gender line and begin transitioning to Deidre McCloskey. The reaction to McCloskey's change was what she later described as Iowa calm. There was no hand-wringing about which restroom she would use. There was no debate in the legislature about changing laws to deal with her announcement. No one expressed anxiety about her leading students astray. Back then, Governor Terry Branstad was asked about McCloskey's transition. The governor's response was refreshing when contrasted with positions our political leaders take today. He asked, "Can she still teach? Does she still have the same academic standing? Well then, what's the problem?" Thank you, Terry. And now from guest columnist Mike Wellman, entitled, "There's Something Happening Here." He says, "I'm starting to wonder if guns aren't more prevalent nowadays in the city where I've lived all my life than I imagined they were in places like Dodge City, Abilene, and Deadwood. The centerpiece of my daily routine since I retired in 2020 is a long walk with my dog first thing in the morning. Besides the exercise, it's a sort of time travel back through my lifetime. We zig all over Waveland Golf Course and zag through Greenwood Park, two primary lifelong venues, and all points in between. I guess I figured the setting for my life is a timeless one, like the set of a long-running TV series or comic strip, impervious to change. But it's not. Polar Vortex 2024 called a temporary halt to that routine. On one of those bitterly cold, forbidding days in mid-January, I was skimming the local newspaper when I'd rather have been out and about. A small article caught my eye about a kid getting sentenced to 10 years in prison. He and another gunslinger, who'd previously been sentenced to 20 years, were convicted for shooting up an after-prom party in the spring of 2022. The incident drew my attention at the time because it happened on Foster Drive in the heart of Des Moines, Honey south of Grand District. After Roosevelt's prom, the 50th reunion of my Roosevelt class was just a few months away. We partied south of Grand in our day, too, but nobody was packing then. Any encounters with police were about bootlegging, illegal possession of alcohol. Nobody graduated from high school into prison. The closure of the shootout on Foster Drive reopened a cold case filed in the back of my mind. In the wee hours of a midsummer morning in 2016, police were called to 45th and Kingman Boulevard, where they found a man lying in the street. He was shot to death while riding his bicycle. A footnote to that homicide emerged in its aftermath when it was reported that, a few hours prior, another had been the victim of a violent assault a couple of blocks away at the corner of Kingman and Polk Boulevard, an intersection where I routinely met up with pals on the way to school when we were in junior high. The incidents were unrelated except for their close proximity in both space and time. I grew up in a house at 44th and Kingman. When we were kids, the worst thing I remember happening was the day one of our pack was hit by a car after school and seriously hurt. He too was riding his bike and ended up sitting out the rest of third grade. I wrote a book some years prior to the still unsolved 2016 slaying about growing up in that idyllic neighborhood. The opening line reads, "Kingman Boulevard was no mean street." Housebound by the weather and vaguely troubled after seeing that story in the paper, I took to the treadmill, ear plugged into a shuffled playlist. "This Must Be the Place" by the Talking Heads, a naive melody about home sweet home. "My City of Ruins" by Bruce Springsteen. "There's a blood red circle on the cold dark ground, and the rain is falling down." Those tunes were just the soundtrack for the dissonance that I was feeling. I stopped walking in place and started sniffing around. Besides the killing on Kingman, there's another cold case, another homicide just a few blocks away a couple of months earlier. Someone else was shot dead at 40th Place and Crocker, right behind the Roosevelt Shopping Center where, when we were teens, the all-center bums, Roosevelt rascals instead of Rough Riders, raised harmless hell. Those were the days of juvenile delinquency. These are the days of tried as adults. Also in the local news in January was an item about foreclosure proceedings against the owner of a short-lived nightclub on Ingersoll. He put a lot of money into a spot that was the site of multiple shootings in the parking lot, as opposed to the joint up the street that my brother opened on a shoestring in the early 1980s. In the quarter century that our family owned and operated it, there were zero gunshot casualties. Besides growing up on Kingman Boulevard, we also grew up on TV westerns like The Rifleman and Gunsmoke. See the 1950s painting on the next page, she says. Young Sammy Six Gun by John Falter, an artist who did lots of Saturday Evening Post covers during that era. That was us. "Have Gun, Will Travel" was about a hitman on horseback who passed out business cards with the title of the show printed on them. I remember feeling glad that I wasn't actually living in the Wild West where your future, we had led to believe, was only as bright as you were quick on the draw. The truth of that era, in that region, though, was that there was serious gun control in force. The shootout at the OK Corral was all about some renegades who refused to disarm when they rode into Tombstone, per the local ordinance. I'm starting to wonder if guns aren't more prevalent nowadays in the city where I've lived all my life than I imagined they were in places like Dodge City, Abilene, and Deadwood in the late 19th century. The reality was that all those frontier towns had stricter weapon regulations on the books than Des Moines does now. I have two sisters. One of them still lives with her family in the house on Kingman that was the headquarters of our childhood. The other lived with hers on Foster Drive for years before moving when she and her husband became empty nesters. Are those old stomping grounds now minefields? Is there something rotten in Des Moines? No, the city is all American as ever, maybe even more so. That hints at the problem. An NBC poll last fall revealed the highest level of gun ownership in the poll's history, which dates to 1999. We're heavily armed and dangerous to one another. Smoke 'em if you got 'em became a popular phrase during World War II. That's what officers told the troops during battlefield intermissions. Smoking declined dramatically over the years since the dangers it poses are added to the product label. Now it's more like shoot 'em if you got 'em with regard to guns, which, combined with the nation's bad mood, are turning our streets into war zones. The old-fashioned bird flip is increasingly given way to more aggressive and violent retaliations against poor merging technique. A report issued last year by the nonprofit group Every Town for Gun Safety found that road rage issues and deaths are increased every year since 2018. All the more reason to walk like we do daily, weather permitting, at Waveland. Shots are still fired with six irons, not six guns. In Greenwood Park, when the pond is ice is thick, it's hockey slap shots that ring out. The rest of the year, it's bird songs. And that does it for this episode of City View. I've been reading from March of 2024. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. And if you have any questions about this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call, 515-243-6833. Thanks again for listening.